Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer. Today is just not our day. We all have connectivity problems, health problems, various things keeping us down. My electricity is off, but nevertheless, we have to soldier through because today is unfortunately a sad day, but still a special day. And that is that Herman Pretorius, who joins me on the podcast today, is leaving the Daily Friend IRR CRA stable, and he's going off to do more exciting things. Herman, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Nick. I must say it's been an absolute privilege and a pleasure, and it's to share the airwaves with you. And you're the master of memes whenever it comes to coping with the state of the country. And Makone, it is really a privilege to share this last show with you. I do think let's make it a good one. I apologize for any, you know, audio issues. That's just my voice. No, I'm kidding. I had my tonsils removed in the last week, which is inadvisable after the age of 6. So do excuse the slight Kermit the Frog sounds emitting from this side. I'll try to keep the Miss Piggy at bay.
Well, thank you for coming on despite your pain and all that. Makone Maja is, of course, joining us as well. Makone, very good to have you back on the show.
Likewise, Nick. And it's such a great honor for me to be here seeing to Herman's farewell. Very glad to be here.
Makone is also, I think you said, having to sit on the edge of your bed to record this episode because of load shedding. Anyway, speaking of load shedding... there seems to be a major crisis unveiling, kind of unraveling, in all of the major metros across the country at the moment, which is that due to load shedding, there are major shortages of water. Cape Town, it's the middle of their dry season, I believe. You know, they do things differently down there from the rest of the country. And as a result, the government in Cape Town has said that they are facing severe water pressures. They're not able to pump as much water as they normally do. Their dams are lower than they wanted. They say that usage of water is rising to levels that were similar to before their hectic campaign to cut down on water usage. And so Cape Town is facing a number of water shortages. At the same time, Tshwane is mayor, has called Rand Water to account for why the city is having such reduced levels of supply of water, and that whether a solution can be found to this problem. Johannesburg is facing exactly the same problem right now, where a large number of reservoirs yesterday and today have been running dry across the city and water is not being able to be pumped in. So it's all really a bit of a mess. And this has led some in the ANC, and I believe Fikile Mbalula was one of them today, to say that the only way that the situation can be resolved is if the ANC declares load shedding a national state of disaster. Again, like we had with COVID. Herman, let me start with you. Is a state of disaster going to solve the problem at all?
No. Oh, you want more than that. So, okay, so the problem is that the purpose of a state of disaster, very rationally, is sometimes you need expedited decision-making and you need, you know, drastic powers for short periods of time without the usual oversight of parliament or cabinet or whatever. So the state of disaster is really for, it's sort of short of a state of emergency being a very specific constitutional framework in which the Bill of Rights can be temporarily impacted in severe ways. But a state of disaster very much is just an expedition mechanism. And I'm curious to know what can be expedited now, what hasn't been available either as a diagnosis or solution since 2008. There's no power, no request, no funding that expedition would make available now that proper governance in the last 15 years would not have ensured otherwise. And it's always dangerous with the expedition of power and decision-making. We saw during lockdown. Now, I, for one, am not convinced that a state of disaster necessarily is a bad thing inherently, but our legislation made quite clear that the protections around it, the ease of extensions around it, far outweigh the democratic and constitutional constraints that should by rights actually be a check on these powers. So for two reasons, I don't think a state of disaster will work. Is number one, just the question of expediency. What is now so hastily needed that hasn't been executable in the last 15 years? And then the second question is, what exactly will be the criteria for exiting the state of disaster? That was the problem that we had with lockdown, is every month on around the 15th or whatever, we would just get a zombie text from a zombie minister and just get this idea that, oh, by the way, another extension of this disaster, another extension without this disaster, another extension without this disaster being solved. So to my mind, it's like the Commission of Inquiry political theater of ye old, you know, the ANC playbook. Is if you can't solve a problem, institute a Commission of Inquiry. If, and now since 2020, if you can't solve a problem and you don't have the political capital to institute a Commission of Inquiry, just declare a state of disaster. It's a way of seeming to do something without doing anything. I've never been quite certain what exactly the reasoning has been for other parties, opposition parties, to push for this, you know, so-called ring-fenced state of disaster. There might be some merit in it. I personally don't see it. And I just don't see what will be solved by this. There are very few questions to which state of disaster is, I think, a rational and constructive answer.
Yeah, I must say, you know, if this was our first rodeo, I think people might be almost kind of thinking, yeah, maybe this is a good idea. I mean, people who are not paying attention, maybe. But we saw, of course, with the national state of disaster around COVID, we had the so-called command council set up, which was issuing all sorts of directives and having secret meetings and not telling us who was on it. And at the height of that absurdity, it was doing things like banning flip-flops and rotisserie chicken while, you know, allowing random other activities. And so I have the horrid, horrid feeling that should there be another state of disaster, we will get this time some sort of electricity command council that will no doubt make equally stupid decisions. I don't know. I can see government very quickly banning the use of ovens between certain times of day or other such things. Makone, what do you make of this mess?
You have to wonder, how do they justify a state of disaster, especially when you look at the manner in which one needs to enact it, right? So it's either through Section 37 of the Constitution or the Disaster Management Act. So with Section 37, you can rule out two of the conditions under which one can declare disaster, right? So things like terrorism would fall under one category, and then pandemics, natural disasters would fall under another. The third comes down to a public emergency, one, of course, that was created by the ANC. And when you look at the statements made by the president, Cyril Ramaphosa, he alluded to needing access to certain instruments. What instruments could the cabinet probably need that they haven't had access to again since 2008? It's power. It's despotic power. Like Herman alluded, they want to be able to expedite certain decisions that they have failed to make over the past 12 years, 14 years. It's just not clear to me what access to what exactly is needed for cabinet to be able to resolve the load shedding issue.
It's very much like a sort of a heroin dealer sort of relationship here, or a battered wife syndrome, which are, you know, traumatic, incapacitating states in which the smallest grace, you create a crisis. You create an addiction, you create a hostile environment, and then you use that hostility, that trauma, to empower yourself to make certain calls. And then you shorten the leash just a bit, and then you get gratitude. So the very, very cynical part that unfortunately didn't go out with the tonsils of my personality is that in between February and the elections 2024, there will be synthetic solutions to everything, to everything related to load shedding. We will either burn through diesel, or it will later transpire that the structural defect at Eskom wasn't as significant. Or, you know, the problem here is just you can see the psychology of abuse playing out here, and the abuser using that psychology of abuse to maintain control. And if we're going to make it practical in terms of geopolitics and socioeconomic or political interests, what tools do they want? Well, Turkish power ships. That's something that a state of disaster would give them lack of access to.
You're right. It's a form of gaslighting. So they declare state of emergency.
I think gaslighting is a very appropriate term in this particular case. Yeah, and I see somewhat what I think foolishly is that the DA, or at least their Shadow Minister for Energy, Kevin Wylam, has said that they support making the Eskom crisis a national state of disaster because they believe it will open up funding to reduce load shedding by up to two stages in the short term. That seems very
open up access to corruption.
Yes, that seems like very foolish
and,
indeed.
And also it implies that resources, financial monetary resources, have been the problem at Eskom. That's patently not the case. They have had so much leeway fiscally, financially, that they could, you know, run 400 billion rands of debt to the extent that they could overshoot what they practically have in terms of return on investment. The idea that it would free up resources makes two stupid presuppositions. Number one, that those resources will be there in the first place. And if Tina Umak-Peterson has been anywhere near your government, you have to count your fingers. And the second question is, let's say the resources are there. Who's going to control the spending? Will it be transparent? Will it be parliamentary oversight subjected? No, of course not. The state of disaster and states of emergencies are there for extreme cases, but it is centralized power. It is the exercise of centralized power. Make no mistake about that.
All right, let's move on to our next topic for today, and that is that the ANC has been under some criticism for having its National Executive Committee and its sort of senior body not be racially representative enough. This is a critique laid particularly by some on the left at the ANC after their latest election conference in December, which found that there were no white people or Indians, I think, on the committee, or not enough at least for the sort of race-obsessed crowd. And so the ANC, bowing to pressure from its alliance partners, has decided to co-opt some people from minority races to demonstrate that it still embraces the idea of a rainbow nation. The National Executive Committee, which can co-opt up to five people, has decided to co-opt four people. They include the SA National AIDS Council chairperson, Stephen Letsike, Deputy Minister of International Relations and Cooperation, Elvin Butz, President Ramaphosa's Parliamentary Councillor, Gerard Kornhoff, and former Etegwini mayor, Fawiza Peer. Makone, does it look like the ANC is embracing white economic empowerment here?
Affirmative action for white people. Never thought I'd see that in my lifetime. I mean, BEE is having a full circle moment. And they're not just justifying it on account of race, but also I think one of the four people that have been co-opted represents the LGBTQI community. So, again, affirmative action taking all its intersectional requirements and factors just now. White people's turn, I see.
It's just, it's also sort of silly. It's like, this is like the ultimate kind of box ticking. We need to make sure that, you know, this thing looks at it. I mean, Herman, you don't have many kind words to say for the people they've co-opted, at least some of them. What's your take on this?
Oh no, they are particularly useless. But that's the thing. The moment you depart from merit-based appointment, don't be surprised if you get people that get outsmarted by a jack in the box. So it's tragic in the sense that not only is race-based judgment and discrimination is in and of itself evil, unfair, stupid, immoral, but it also robs you just of the basic criteria for competence. It is the gateway drug to so many unnecessary and destructive consequences, even for the ANC in and of itself. If the ANC had truly been a non-racial, competent party, the party of Luthuli and Plaatje and Dube, then they would have attracted and continued attracting competent people from across the racial spectrum. But that ceased at some point, and we have to ask why. That ceased during the Mbeki era. If Karl Niehaus is sort of the most prominent white representative within the ANC, you have to ask what happened to just the ordinary caliber of leadership, not even along racial lines, that, you know, talking crumpet like that could be prominent within a party and have actual political capital to spend. And that's because the moment you get rid of competence, of race-based, of merit-based judgment calls, you just sign your own death warrant. And I don't usually do this. I don't usually do this, or I try to suppress this instinct. But there's a comment here and there that I'm just not going to let go. It's from Joe Bloggs, that says, black people in South Africa are not builders. They are just crass consumers and I suppose you meant to say petty racists. You wrote pretty racists, which at least has some complimentary component, but petty racist, we are doomed. I mean, that is like saying that all Afrikaners are oppressive apartheid apparatchiks. The nonsense of attributing to a political party or to a race group, the incompetence of a political party is just so fundamentally, historically ignorant, I can't even start to explain it properly. You want an explanation between failure and success? Look at North Korea and South Korea, the exact same race, the exact damn gene pool, and you have two different stories. Look at West and East Germany, the exact same gene pool, the exact same color palette, for goodness sake, and you've got failure and success. If you're going to start thinking that criticizing the ANC as ZANU-PF, and that gives you moral high ground, and then go on by just casually, racistly describing people you don't even know as pretty racists, perhaps firstly, I would get your grade 4 grammatical report card back. But then secondly, I would also get another crowd to hang with, because I'm afraid the reality is that solutions come not from race, but from the ideas that underlie them. Right. And Makone and I share those ideas.
And this has been a problem of South Africa for its entire existence, is that everyone refuses to look at the fact that South Africa has been governed by bad ideas for more than a century. And it is only when we get rid of those bad ideas and stop just redressing them up in new forms that we're actually going to fix any of the problems that we have had for a very long time. Makone, any final words?
BEE tends to do exactly what we've just seen, which it brings or allows racists to rear their ugly heads again and attribute stupidity to whole populations and whole groups of people. That's very ignorant. But I think back to the NEC co-opting whites and Indians into their top 80, 90, 95 structures. I wonder though, because the premise of BEE is to have a person represent people who again look like them. So are these people going to be advancing the white agenda in the ANC? Are they going to speak on behalf of white people and Indian people? How do they manage that?
All of these race games are so pathetic and stupid. But anyway, it's just funny to see that the ANC couldn't deal with their own sort of contradictions of how it has all of these commitments to representativity, but then didn't suddenly realize that it actually didn't care about that because it cares about ideology.
What I actually am waiting for is for more nuanced, precisely aimed ANC racism. Is I want to know whether the president of the ANC is genetically at least 7% white. Because if we're gonna climb on this hog, let's not half hog it. Let's whole hog it all the way.
Ugh, it's all just a ridiculous joke. Speaking of something that's not a joke, though, that's deeply depressing, is that there are apparently 36,000 patients in Gauteng on a waiting list for operations in Gauteng public hospitals. The worst of these is Chris Hani Baragwanath Hospital, which I believe is also, I think, Gauteng's biggest hospital in Soweto, where there is a waiting list of 10,900 people. There are, of those 10,000 people, 1,700 of them of patients who will wait 4 years and 5 months for hip and knee replacements, which is pretty gruesome stuff. I think my camera has died. Anyway, sorry about that. While I fix that, there are also backlogs in cataract surgery, which is seeing a significant number of people outstanding, I think 10,000 across the province. Herman, what is the cause of this incredible backlog in our healthcare system, where people are going to have to wait for sometimes years, possibly never, if they have anything that might be a deteriorating condition, may never even get to that appointment? What do you make of the story?
It's the centralization of decision making. The decisions you make in your personal life is actually quite complex. We all three pitched up here today, at least, clothed from the waist up. Nick, I can't speak for you. But we didn't get
him. I'll never reveal my secrets.
Yes, that's certainly what we call it. We didn't get a memo to make a decision to get dressed. But yet something went into that decision, because I bought this shirt perhaps a year ago from a store that I visited that was within the socioeconomic price range of what I could afford. It looked like a nice-ish color. I know currently it gives off real Guantanamo feel because of the yellow wall, but believe me, it's nicer than it looks. The point is that the decision just to buy the shirt for McCorney, just to buy the blouse for you, Nick, just to buy that shirt, was a surprisingly complex chain of events that took what you had available, what your needs were, what someone else had to offer, and bringing it all together in something of a, oh dear, I hope I, ah, my corner's back, in something of a framework of decision making. Now think about the complexity of medical decisions. Medical decisions have far more severe consequences and input going into them, because they are literally life affecting, life changing. If you are going to centralize the decision making of millions of people, you have to control for innumerable numbers of counterfactuals, eventualities, risks. And of course, you have to, at the end of the day, balance that towards the income of your government that you get through revenue. Now, because the pit of human decrepitude and illness is literally bottomless, the moment you take responsibility as a collective for eradicating that pit or filling that pit without some strict parameters of safety of when it can actually work and not work, you are signing up for failure. Because every decision made by every individual about their own health can be made at the same time, within a minute, millions of people can make the same decision. But no matter what process, and South Africa isn't known for our effective processes, no matter what process you implement at a state level, you have to upload the complexity of that decision-making into a system staffed by incompetent people, cadres and cronies, or in systems designed in 1995 when, I don't know, Madonna was still, had the body of a man half her age. And then you have to incorporate the problem of coping with the fact that socioeconomic deprivation, the likes of which South Africa faces, makes people intensely vulnerable. You combine all of those factors and you get to a point where the decisions are unmakeable and the solutions are unaffordable and any future planning is unquantifiable. So the moment you have centralization about something as complex as health for a country as big as South Africa with the amount of problems faced on a health basis by South Africa, you are begging for failure. And we are seeing limping chickens coming home to roost because of the centralization. And it didn't start under the ANC. But it's not going to end under the ANC either.
So I believe I read relatively recently that the government's great plan for fixing, or in our opinion, destroying healthcare in South Africa is the National Health Insurance Scheme, which I believe is at least partially based off of Canada. Makone, just before the show, you were sharing some thoughts on the Canadian healthcare system.
Yeah, right. So we speak about how inefficient South Africa's processes are, but even in top first world countries like Canada, you see that the universal healthcare system just does not work. I think I read that the Ontario Medical Association in Canada was reporting over 1 million surgeries in backlog. And like South Africa, they're scapegoating COVID, but we know that public health administered at that level, at the country, national, wide, universal level, just does not work. Even worse, in Canada, you have backlog surgeries in pediatric cases, right? And when you think of a hip or a knee replacement, you typically, I think, the image of an old person comes to mind, but now it comes all the way down to children. And that is a good preview into what South Africa is going to look like if it adopts NHI.
Yeah, I think healthcare is interesting in that it's an area of policy that's sort of the world over. You know, you struggle to think of a country that seems to have its healthcare policy in a good place. Like a place like the US, their system is ridiculously complicated. It's really expensive. Canada, they have backlogs. In Britain, the UK, they have funding shortages and they have backlogs there too. I think this is going to be, unfortunately, a problem. And in some ways, I think South Africa's private system is a really good example. Because it's actually pretty well run and it's relatively affordable.
And
the goal should perhaps be getting more people into the private system rather than trying to just tear down the private system.
There are incidents of people from the UK coming to South Africa for the private sector cancer treatment here. Because it's just more efficient and ironically more cost affordable. But I must say all of this comes down not to an idea about race, because one of the most stupid tweets ever was tweeted by one of the most, Caucasian politicians of the last 30 years, Gordon, pause while mouth open Brown. He said that you can't charge the sick for being sick. And I was just like, you cretin. How can you walk and think at the same time with that cognitive capacity? You're not charging the sick because they're sick. You're charging it because it takes time to train a doctor to diagnose the illness. It takes space to have the real estate for a hospital bed. It takes knowledge to develop the medicine, the equipment. And then these people at the end of the day need to eat. If you're going to get to a stupid point of saying, oh, we can't charge the sick for being sick, or it's immoral to try and make money from curing disease, I mean, practically, let's just get rid of technology, hey-ho, and get back to paint and feathers, because that's all we will have left. And, treat each other with half a badger at the full moon. The problem here is if you start from a stupid idea, you're going to end up in a place of unworkable moral conflict. And I think my last thing that I'll ever say on a Daily Friend show here is that you can't be compassionate by committing to spend other people's money while denying the people most in need the opportunity to earn their own. That's not compassion. That's control and that's abuse.
That's really poor logic. You can't charge the sick for being sick. You can't charge humans for being alive. Like, you
Well,
can.
Gordon Brown's political career did not end in glory. Let's just put it that way. yeah, this is exactly why I think we need to start looking at kind of more out of the box solutions, things like health vouchers, which kind of, you know, will say the government will cover the costs of people who are poor, but it will allow them to choose a healthcare provider, which decentralizes the decision making, creates competition in the industry. That's kind of the stuff that you need to start looking at. Anyway, with that, Herman, thank you so much for all the times on the show. It's been great. You know, today as well, you had some zingers, which are good fun, and we're gonna miss you. Thanks for being on all the shows, and thanks to everyone for watching. We hope that you found it interesting. Sorry, it was all a little bit over the place today. I think just isn't our day, but I hope you all have a wonderful day, and we'll see you tomorrow on the Daily Quinn Show. Cheers, everyone.